Campbell is the author of The Iron Lady from Grocer's Daughter to Iron Lady and joins us on the program this morning. 1-300-800-222 if you'd like to join us. Hello, John.
Hello, good afternoon, or middle of the night where you are.
John, can we ask firstly, was the term Iron Lady a fair description of Margaret Thatcher?
I think it probably was. She was a very unusually single-minded and determined politician, yeah. She was more cautious than she liked to admit. She was a very shrewd politician, but she was pretty tough. When she knew what she thought and she knew what she wanted, even though she was more cautious than people think in how she approached it.
Let's go back to then when she was a grocer's daughter. Was her father's influence in her life a major impact on her political views?
I think it was, although to a lesser extent than she sort of canonized him after his death. In fact, when she was young, she got away from Grantham and away from her father as quickly as she could and went back as rarely as she could. But she, undoubtedly, being brought up in a small town in, he was an influential councillor and mayor of the town. She was brought up in local politics. She was brought up the daughter of a shopkeeper, which I think was very important. That influenced her whole sort of economic outlook. And I think he brought her up to an idea of public service and of sort of high standards. In a way, I think it was a more general influence than a more specific one, if you understand.
And was her mother strong? Because she's an incredibly strong woman.
Her mother, she hardly mentions at all. People have commented on the fact that she barely mentions any influence of her mother. She implies that she was entirely her father's daughter. I think her father brought her up to be the son that he never had. And I think she was brought up with a sort of quite masculine view. And she rather despised her mother and her sister and probably her daughter, actually. She had a very masculine view of the world.
When, during her younger years and her view on politics, did that stay with her from there through university and her time in university?
Absolutely. Her time at university made very little impact on her ideas at all, to an extraordinary degree. She came to Oxford with her views pretty firmly already formed, and what she did at Oxford was use the time for sort of networking and getting to know useful contacts in the conservative organisation, which stood her in good stead later on. She didn't really indulge in any sort of ferment of ideas at Oxford. Partly because she was a chemist, so she was involved. She was rather out of the loop, if you understand, of political debate. She wasn't, as a woman, of course, she couldn't be a member of the union, so she wasn't involved in those sort of debates. Oxford had very. She didn't enjoy Oxford very much, and I don't think it left very much mark on her.
How does a grocer's daughter go to Oxford?
By being a clever, hard-working girl at school and winning a place. There was more opportunity then, arguably, than there is now. She worked hard. She didn't win a scholarship to Oxford, but she did get a place at Oxford. It was during the war, which possibly made it easier for a girl to get in, except the women's colleges must have had a fixed intake, so I think that's not a reason. It certainly made it easier for her to get on in things like Conservative Association, because most of the men were off at the war, so she was the second woman to be chairman or president of the Conservative Association. She certainly had an opportunity there because people were away at the war. Oxford was a very different place the years she was there.
Did her beliefs in her conservatism change? Were they still as strong and were they the same when she was at university as they were when she actually went into politics?
Oh, I think so. I think, in a way, she went undercover for 20 years or so when she was making her career in the rather more centrist conservative party of Harold Macmillan and Ted Heath in the 50s and 60s. She kept her head down pretty well, and when it was only when the tides have turned in favour of her rather more right-wing views that she came out again with the sort of things she had been saying when she was a young candidate in the general election after the war, 1950. She was quite a sort of tough conservative as a young candidate. But as I say, she then towed the party line rather more for 20 years while she was making her way, and quite surprised people by coming out with her sort of gut conservatism when, as I say, the tide turned in her favour in the 70s.
What was it that turned that? I should point out, because she, when did you, we talked about her being a chemist, she then studied law.
Yes, she studied law at the same time as she was having her children. You know, she read for the bar. She had married by that time, so Dennis was sort of supporting her reading for the bar. Yes, she rather regretted doing chemistry at university because she always wanted to get into politics, and she thought law was a better basis for getting into politics than chemistry would have been. So she spent her early married life, reading for the bar and then practicing quite briefly as a tax lawyer. But she got into Parliament fairly early on. Well, I mean, she was 30. What was she? She was 34 when she got into Parliament.
Was it her strength that gave her the ability to get into Parliament, or was she at that time working through and she wasn't showing her colours until she did later?
She got into Parliament by sort of hard work and determination, as much as anything else, I think. I mean, you couldn't keep her down because she was so single-minded. A key of her whole life, from school onwards to when she was Prime Minister, was doing her homework. She did her homework. She was always fantastically well informed. She could win arguments, and she impressed selection committees when she was trying to stand for Parliament. There was a considerable prejudice against women in the 50s, and she was a young mother with children. A lot of people felt she, at that time, stayed home looking after the children. She was up against people, men who had a good war. It was quite extraordinary how she managed to get adopted for about the fourth or fifth seat she stood for, which, I mean, people think she ran into prejudice, but she overcame that prejudice very quickly. She was one of the first women, she was certainly the first woman with young children to get into Parliament and get into government. I mean, she was a force of nature, really. She did have tremendous energy and determination. And she beat down all opposition, really.
Yeah. One of the things that comes through in the book and also in the film is the fact that she refused not to be heard.
Absolutely, yes. I think that's right. She was very determined. She was not going to be treated as a woman. She was going to stand on her own feet and compete with the men, and she did.
1-300-800-222 is the number to call, or text 0437-774-774. Clive says he's very pro-Margaret Thatcher and that she was a good leader. Was that one of the aspects that was recognised in her from a young age and from her moves into politics early, that she was potentially a leader?
Oh, I think not. Partly because she was a woman, and people simply at that date did not think it conceivable that a woman could be a leader of a party. They thought she was a good middle-ranking, hard-working minister. I don't think anyone saw the leadership potential in her, and I think she didn't really display it until, I mean, she did keep her head down until suddenly the opportunity came and she stepped into the limelight and blossomed and turned into the personality and the actress loving the limelight, which she later became. During her earlier years as a junior minister, she attracted very little attention and was thought to be a fairly dull, conventional, middle of the road a minister. I think people didn't see her coming because although they thought she was hardworking, they didn't think she had any sort of spark of originality, and they thought she was rather right-wing, which in the Tory party of McMillan and Heath was the wrong stance.
We'll take some calls and come back to taking a look at her life historically. Hello, Mike.
Oh, g'day. Yes, sir, I love the show. Yeah, that definitely. Margaret Thatcher was definitely a necessary antidote at the time to the trade union movement and the enormous damage that was doing at Britain, you know, in those times with all the communist agitation. I think it's the same with, to be honest, I hate to say it, but it's the same with all women politicians. It still wasn't necessarily democracy. The culture of democracy just wasn't there. That was her main downfall. Well, it was her downfall, that she just, being so single-minded and determined, she just didn't listen to other people, which is fundamental, I think, in a politician.
Well,
she went to the same school as my mum, actually. Yeah.
Well, Mike, we'll come back to that, to the downfall of Margaret Thatcher, a little bit later. It's a good point to bring up, though, the trade union monopoly and the influence that that had on forming Margaret Thatcher. That policy and that stand that she took against the union was one of the biggest ones, I guess, that she had to do, John.
Yes, absolutely. But again, she was very lucky in her timing, in a sense. She came to power as the reaction against the dominance of the unions, which had really defeated three previous prime ministers. Because when Ted Heath, 10 years earlier, Ted Heath was defeated by the unions, by the miners particularly, because the unions were still pretty popular at that time, and it was difficult for him to stand against the unions. By the time Mrs. Thatcher came in, the unions had overreached themselves, had gone too far. People said something must be done, they must be sorted out. She still approached it quite carefully and cautiously. I mean, people forget that she did it in about five different salami slicing stages without giving them a big battle of the sort that they had against Ted Heath. She was very subtle and quite cautious in the way she did it, but she did have public opinion was basically behind her by then, which 10 years earlier it wouldn't have been. So she was a reaction. She was expressing a very widely felt reaction that something had to be done about the unions.
We will pick up then where we were talking about her introduction. And when was it recognised that she may have the potential to be a leader? And how was she groomed into that position?
Well, only really after she'd become leader, in a sense. I mean, she was very lucky that about three or four other much better qualified people, for one reason or another, had fallen by the wayside and didn't stand. I mean, he still had the loyalty of most of his colleagues who would have, if any one of them had stood against Heath, if, you know, Willie Whitelaw or Jim Pryor had stood, they would have won. If Edward Buchan had not felt tainted by his business, you know, there were scandals about his business. If Enoch Powell had still been in the Conservative Party, he might have won. I mean, Mrs. Thatcher was not really, Keith Joseph was the standard bearer of her sort of wing of the party, but he pulled out. I mean, she was left saying, you know, if no one else will stand for our wing of the party, I will. And everyone was pretty taken aback by this. But they thought, you know, good for her. She's got guts. We'll back her. There'll be something quite good for the Tory party to have the first woman leader. But they didn't know what they were electing when they elected her. And most of the shadow cabinet was still very suspicious of her and against her. It took her a long time to establish her leadership of the party. She was treated with a lot of suspicion and hostility by the establishment of the Tory party. I mean, she was the result of what was called at the time of a peasants' revolt in the party against Ted Heath. She won on a sort of negative vote rather than a positive one in many ways.
Barry Everingham joins us. Hello, Barry.
G'day, mate. How are you?
I'm good. You interviewed Margaret Thatcher.
Yes, I was working for the Australian newspaper in London. I was sent over there in 1978. And I had about an hour with her at number 10. And I came out absolutely gobsmacked. I thought she was insane with some of the things, some of her things she had in line for Britain. And, you know, I had a mate who was a Conservative peer, not a peer who was created. You know, he was an hereditary peer. And he said to me she was the only person in the Conservative Party with balls. And that, you know, the establishment in England never accepted her. You know, it's a class-driven society. And, you know, she was never allowed to forget, really, that she was a grocer's daughter from Grantham. It was really quite outrageous. I mean, they were glad that she got them back time and time again, a bit like Howard here. But, you know, when I came back to Australia, she was out here. I've forgotten what she came for. Malcolm Fraser introduced me to her at Parliament House one night. And instead of saying, how do you do, or anything, she launched straight in and said, do you know George Negus? I said, yes, Prime Minister, I do. She said, he had the temerity today to interrupt me while I was being interviewed by him. That's very difficult to, you know, what do you say? Oh, really?
Barry, did you have a sense of how powerful she was?
Oh, God, yes, she was as powerful as anything. But, you know, I don't think she was ever loved by the party. You know, John Howard, remember that cover story in the Bulletin years ago? They had a picture of him under the caption, why does this man try? John Howard was never terribly popular with the Conservatives. They learned to love him because he got them back time and time again, as Margaret Thatcher did. But in that class-driven society in England, she was more or less sneered at, I think. That was the impression I got anyhow.
Barry, I'll just go back to John. Does that ring true for you, John?
Yes, up to a point. I mean, I think it's certainly the old Tory establishment absolutely did not accept her and thought she was a disaster. They thought she'd be a temporary aberration and they'd get back to normal soon. But the rank and file of the party, I think, did love her. And she was unusual as a Tory leader in that she actually loved the rank and file of the party, which most of the leaders hate. And she did gather around her a much younger generation of younger ministers and younger MPs who did and still do. I mean, a lot of the Tories today were people who came into politics under Mrs. Thatcher, and they still look back to her with adoration. But it is true that the Tories of her own generation were very suspicious of her indeed and never did accept her. You're right.
Did she have a very singular view on how to govern and how to rule, in that she didn't consult very much? Because that's an impression that comes through, especially when you take a look at the film.
Well, I think the film inevitably exaggerates and makes it look as if it was one heroic woman standing alone against a lot of pygmies. I mean, she wasn't in a position to do that. She was surrounded in her first government in particular by a lot of cabinet members who were not really of her way of thinking, whom she had to some extent to bypass, to some extent she had to bring them along with her. She was quite clever at marginalizing them and getting what she wanted, and gradually she was able to get rid of them and surround herself with colleagues who were more of her way of thinking, or arguably were more sort of yes men who didn't argue with her. She became, like all prime ministers, like all leaders, more autocratic the longer she went on. But as I said at the beginning, she was quite cautious most of the time, at least in the early stages, until the end. She wasn't as autocratic as she tends to be portrayed, but I mean, the film is quite right that by the end she was getting to be autocratic and she didn't listen to people, and that was one of the causes of her downfall.
Did she make good decisions most of the time? We can take a look at the Falklands as well, because in Britain that was seen as being very strong and her doing the right thing.
Well, the Falklands is an odd episode altogether. I mean, she partly caused that to happen by sending out to the Argentina all the signals that they had good reason to think that she was not interested in the islands and would not defend them. When they did, it was such a sort of national humiliation that even Michael Foot from the left was calling on her, something must be done. She pretty well had to respond with force, otherwise it would have brought her down. She was very lucky, really. She was very single-minded, she was very strong, and she was lucky that the war was won with so few casualties. But it should never have happened, really, if she had played her cards more sensibly in the first place.
She turned it around politically.
Even though the war was being fought, she was very clever and very strong in the way she listened to the to the military and acted on their advice. She didn't try to tell the military how to do it. So she was lucky, but she deserved her luck, I would say, on the Falklands.
And within that, does it show how politically astute that she is, that she took a negative and turned it into a positive for her?
Yes, I think that's right. I think she did manage to turn it into a positive. But I think it must be stressed that, you know, she was quite lucky with that. A lot could very easily have gone wrong if some of those exocets had gone off and things like that. A couple more ships sunk and she would have been in much deeper trouble than she was.
Ken joins us. Hello, Ken.
Morning, Trev. There's two things I can remember about Margaret Thatcher. The first and most, maybe the most important, was that she was a very good friend of Ronald Reagan's. And between Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, they're responsible for the massive debt problems that Britain and America have at the moment. The second, because of what they call Reaganomics, but really she was in on it just as much as he was. The second one was the Falklands War, which, as was just talking about, didn't need to be fought, but she figured that Britain's land had to be defended, so she went and sacrificed men and ships to do it, which is crazy. But she won the war, she won the next election, so it obviously worked for her.
John, just her relationship with foreign leaders, we just brought up Reagan there. I've also got a text here that says Thatcher lost me when she supported the dictatorship in Chile of Pinochet. What were her relationships like with leaders from other countries? And if we can talk about Pinochet as well.
Oh, that's difficult to generalize. I mean, she did have this very, very good relationship with Reagan, although, and it wasn't as personal as they managed to sort of make it look. I mean, she had a pretty, candidly, she didn't think Reagan was very on the ball with a lot of ideas. I mean, she was lucky that Reagan allowed her to speak for the West to a great extent. Very, I mean, Reagan was extraordinary in that he had remarkably little ego himself in that way, and was prepared at summits to let her handle the detail. He was broad brush; he didn't know the detail, he gave her a lot of rope, which she used very successfully to almost make it look as if, you know, she was a third party between Reagan and Gorbachev, for instance. I mean, she managed to, as the phrase is, you know, punch above her weight there. But, I mean, one shouldn't exaggerate how important she really was, I think. She managed to persuade Reagan that Gorbachev was different, and she could do business and he could do business with Gorbachev. But she didn't approve of a lot of Reagan's economic policies. She did think his view of the deficit was very irresponsible. She was much more economically sound than Reagan was. So she had an odd relationship with Reagan, really. But I mean, she did exploit it for all it was worth, very successfully. With other leaders, I mean, Pinochet, she was grateful too, because he gave support in the Falklands, and so she thought he was therefore to be treated as a friend. Afterwards, she wasn't very good with most foreign leaders. She liked being top dog. She wasn't very good at cooperating with others. She pretty much despised all the European leaders. She had a wary respect for Indira Gandhi, I think, as another woman in politics. They had a certain amount in common personally, although not politically. I don't know, she did get on with Gorbachev because they liked arguing with each other, and she liked that and he liked that.
Hello, Ken.
Yeah, the funny thing about the Thatcher reign, you know, is straight after the Second World War, when England was never more broke, a bloke called Clement Attlee set up the socialist state, like free hospitals, free dental, free this and free that, you know. Now, that was affordable for the next 40 years, even under Tories like Eden, Macmillan, Home, Edward Heath and so forth. It wasn't until Thatcher got in 1979, when Britain was never more affluent with the North Sea oil and so forth, guess what? We can't afford to look after our people anymore. And the only reason they got away with it, her and Reagan got away with that sort of bloody stuff, you know, was because of the demonising over decades by the Murdoch press and others of the vulnerable. And that's how the unions got belted down, you know, over bloody years and years of negativity and attacking their vulnerability. And that's why without that, Reagan and Thatcher would never have been around, you know.
John, just a comment?
I think that's an interesting view, yes. The only thing is you have to see Mrs. Thatcher as part of a sort of global reaction against socialism. It wasn't just in Britain. It was pretty much worldwide. Maybe you could say the Murdoch press was having a worldwide influence as well. But no, I mean, there has been that sort of turning on its head of the view of social progress as it was imagined in the 50s and 60s and into the 70s. And certainly we've had these last, you know, 30 years of unregulated capitalism, which one couldn't have imagined earlier, having the effect it has had. So yes, I mean, it is exactly the irony that in your listener points out. I think that's quite true.
So she did have the opinion that it wasn't up to government to look after the poor. That if you had the opportunities, that anybody could pick themselves up and become successful and do something for themselves.
Yes, that was the ideology. I mean, it has to be said that, in fact, she did not roll back the level of the welfare state all that much. I mean, she cut some benefits. She cut quite a lot of benefits. But the actual level of state spending continued to expand, as it does. You know, she was trying to run up a down escalator, really, the whole time, trying to restrain a public spending. So, I mean, it's not, you know, I mean, the, you know, all the talk of Tory cuts needs to be seen in that perspective.
A couple of texts, Facebook comments that have come through. A divisive Britain that provided opportunities for the haves whilst insurance entrenched poverty for the have-nots. Someone else said she killed British Leyland. Grr. And sale of government assets, which led to monopolies being able to charge what they wanted. Was she one of the first to take on that idea of the sale of government assets that was picked up possibly later by other governments?
Yes, I think she was. She became a great standard bearer for that. Though again, she did it fairly cautiously at the beginning, and they started off. It wasn't a great ideological crusade. It was done as a sort of practical way of raising money for, you know, British Telecom in the first instance, and then it turned out to be quite so popular that people would buy shares in it. So they made it into a sort of popular ideological crusade. It didn't end up with a lot of small shareholders at all, as your listener said. It ended up with a lot of private monopolies. And I don't think it's been, in fact, very successful now, particularly the privatisation of the railways is beginning to look like a complete disaster.
And haven't we seen that in a lot of governments?
But I mean, I think she did. The greatest effect 30 years on that one can see that she had was greater inequality, a much more American style of society with you know, great wealth to the wealthy and increased poverty to the poorer. I mean, she's got away from the sort of social democratic idea, which is still more dominant on continental Europe. She was trying to make us more American as a society, and I think she's very much a much more commercial society, and I think that, and a more unequal society, and I think that is the legacy that she has had, which it's difficult to know whether we're now seeing a backlash against that or not. But as your listener said, I mean, the whole ethos spread by the right-wing press, the Murdoch press and others, is that it's very difficult for any party, even the Labour Party, to fight back against that now. That is the ethos we've been living with, and in spite of the credit crunch, it's hard to see you reversing it.
John, what was her home life like with Dennis and that relationship, and how important was that to her?
I think the film slightly sentimentalizes the relationship with Dennis. It was very much in their early years, it was pretty much a marriage of convenience. I mean, Carol Thatcher's book describes it as such, I think. Dennis had his own business career, was away out of the country in South Africa and going around Africa all the way, in the days when there were no mobile phones or satellites or anything else. He was out of touch for months at a time, had very little to do with her early career. By the time she was Prime Minister, he was retired because he was 10 years older than her, which is something the film gets very wrong by making it look as if they're the same age. He was an older man. He was a very good, loyal support to her in the background. But, you know, they were, you know, and she relied on him to give her that stability in her home life. But she saw very little of her children. She sacrificed her family very much to her ambition. And I think, you know, all her talk of family values was pretty hypocritical, really. She was an ambitious, driven career woman. And her family life was pretty empty. And I think she's been, sadly, reaping the result of that for the last 20 years.
Did she... I'll go back to calls in just one second. What did she do in her spare time? Or did she live and breathe politics? Did she play bridge? Did she go and play tennis? Did she like to cook?
She lived and breathed politics almost entirely. I mean, she slept very little. She worked. She loved working. She had no outside interests or hobbies at all, which is, as I say, partly why she's been so bereft since she left office. There's nothing worse than an unemployed workaholic. And she was thrown out when she thought she was still in her prime and still had a country to run. I think she was deeply unhappy from the moment she left office. She loved being in office. She devoted every minute of her day to politics and governing the country, and she was lost without it.
Michael joins us. Hello, Michael.
Trevor, how are you?
Good, thank
you. Look, a really interesting discussion. A couple of moments ago, John, you sort of summed up just about everything that I was going to perhaps touch on here and there. I just think that, in a short discussion like this, probably the best thing I think I could express my views with is to say that in terms of temperament and sensibility, she seemed a very cruel person whenever she gave a speech. There was never anything that would really be inspiring. There was nothing about kindness, even sort of fake. And she really didn't apologise for the fact that people would suffer. So she wasn't saying, well, look, on the one hand, we'll... she made some token gestures. Was it her, John, who introduced the concept of the trickle-down effect?
Well, she certainly popularised it, yes. I mean, I think probably the idea came from America, didn't it? But no, I think what you say is right. She wasn't in the business of showing sort of compassion or a soft side. She thought running the government was a serious business about money. She had very little time for sentimental gestures.
Did she ever tell a joke? Did she ever laugh?
No, not really. She didn't understand jokes when other people made them. No, she had no sense of humour, really. She had very little sense of irony. She was very literal-minded. She believed in facts. This was the chemistry of her training, I think. Her chemistry, and she was a tax lawyer. She saw things very much in black and white, which was a strength politically in many ways, but it was also... it was also a weakness. She did lack imagination to know what other people were thinking or feeling.
I'm just trying to remember.
And I think this helped to bring her down in the end.
I'm just trying to remember back with seeing her interviewed, and every time I saw her smoke, it was almost like sometimes she smirked more than smiled.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, she was a teacher, really. She wanted to explain things to people and tell them how they ought to live better than they did. She really wasn't interested in relaxation for herself and didn't really understand that other people enjoyed other things than work in their life. So she did lack imagination of how other people lived and felt.
Joan?
I lived in Britain through Margaret Thatcher, and that woman took the great out of Great Britain.
In what way?
In my opinion. Well, the first thing that she did was to sell off all the council housing. They could buy it from themselves. Some of them were as cheap as my mother's was offered as $5,000 at the time. It caused terrible arguments amongst families, amongst streets in the UK. But one of the things I wanted to suggest to the gentleman that's taken the program is they have somebody in this country who not only got a scholarship to where did she get her scholarship? She didn't get a scholarship to Oxford. This person's got a scholarship to Oxford and also one to Cambridge. And she's been working hard in this country and doing all she can, because it's my daughter, to get things really nice in this country. But that woman is... You mentioned that name, I was half asleep, and it was as if you'd given me an electric shock.
Joan, thank you. I just want to move on because we've got about 2 minutes to the news. John, what was Margaret Thatcher's downfall?
Oh, several things, really. Partly the poll tax, which was very unpopular and made a lot of Tory MPs think they were going to lose their seats unless they changed the leader. Probably more important was that she antagonised, really, and alienated her senior colleagues. She was very bad at handling colleagues. She was very disloyal, in fact. She quarrelled with the most senior supporters, like Geoffrey Howe and Nigel Lawson, who had been, you know, who were good Thatcherites, really. She couldn't handle the... She did become autocratic, high-handed, impossible to deal with. And after a bit, the cabinet simply felt they'd had enough. And given that she was unpopular because of the poll tax, that they thought they were going to lose the next election, all these things came together. She was seen as very anti-European, which a lot of her colleagues thought this was a disastrous stance towards Europe. All these things came together and brought her down. But, you know, it was probably personality and high-handedness and the fact that she'd just been there long enough. 10 years, 11 years is enough for any leader.
John, we've got 30 seconds to the news. How is she now?
Oh, I think she is a rather sad figure now. She doesn't really appear in public. She cannot speak in public. She has Alzheimer's, I think, or dementia, certainly. So she is a rather sad figure. She's still alive, but takes no part in public life.
John, it's been a pleasure talking to you this morning. Thank you so much for bringing the life of Margaret Thatcher to us on the program.
Okay, thank you very much. Delighted.
John Campbell, who's the author of The Iron Lady, From Grocer's Daughter to Iron Lady. And if you haven't seen the film, it's a terrific movie. And it's a great book too, taking a look at her life.